Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, imagine we're doing an economic MRI. We're not just looking at, say, inflation or unemployment in isolation. No, we're looking at the intricate network connecting them all.
The whole system.
Exactly. And our sources today give us this really fascinating scan showing how pulling just one economic lever can send ripples, sometimes surprising ones, through everything.
Yeah, and understanding those connections is, well, it's absolutely crucial.
So our mission, to trace those ripples, basically, to give you a clearer picture of why big economic decisions are, never really made in a vacuum.
And think about it from the policymakers' view. They're constantly facing this challenge, right? Fix one thing, maybe inflation, but you risk making unemployment worse, or vice versa.
A delicate dance.
It really is like a multidimensional chess game almost. So our goal here is to help you understand the why behind the economic headlines, not just the what.
Okay, let's start unpacking this. Maybe begin with something that sounds simple but isn't. The value of money. Our sources talk about its dual nature, internal and external.
Yeah, that's a great starting point. Because it's definitely more layered than it seems. First, you've got the internal value. That's its purchasing power right here at home. You know, how many groceries, how many goods, how many services can one unit of your currency actually buy?
Your domestic buying power.
Exactly. Then there's the external value, and that's its value compared to other currencies. Think exchange rates. How much foreign currency can you get for your dollar or your euro or whatever it is?
Okay, so internal is what it buys here. External is what it buys abroad or how it stacks up globally.
You got it.
So the big question then, how does inflation mess with these two values? If prices are rising fast at home, does that automatically weaken the currency internationally?
Well, there's a very strong link our sources point out. Inflation directly hits the internal value, right? Prices go up, your money buys less. That's straightforward. But the interesting part is how that often spills over. A falling internal value because of inflation tends to weaken the currency's external value, too.
Why is that? Loss of confidence.
Pretty much. If investors and traders see a currency losing its buying power domestically, they lose confidence in holding it. They might sell it, demand goes down, and the exchange rate depreciates.
And the sources mentioned this can kick off a nasty feedback loop, kind of vicious cycle.
Precisely. That depreciation makes imports more expensive. You need more domestic currency to buy foreign goods.
So those pricier imports then feed back into domestic inflation.
Exactly. That's what we call imported inflation. It can become a downward spiral if it's not managed.
Wow.
And this really highlights the challenge for, governments and central banks, particularly in open economies. They have to juggle both the internal value controlling inflation and the external value managing the exchange rate. It's tough.
Yeah, you can see how trying to fix one might impact the other quite directly.
Definitely. We've seen cases where high domestic inflation led to a full-blown currency crisis because international confidence just evaporated.
Okay, so that link between internal confidence and external value is clear. Let's broaden the lens now to the balance of payments, the BOPI. What exactly is that capturing?
So the balance of payments, or BOPP, is essentially a country's ledger for all its financial dealings with the rest of the world.
Everything. Trade, investment.
Everything. All transactions between a country's residents, consumers, businesses, the government, and everybody else. It's like the nation's international bank statement.
And how does inflation tie into this big picture?
Well, think about it. If your country has higher inflation than others, your goods become relatively more expensive on the world market.
Less competitive.
Right. So what happens? Your exports tend to fall because they're pricier for foreigners to buy. And at the same time, imported goods look relatively cheaper to your domestic consumers, so imports tend to rise.
Okay, so fewer exports, more imports. That sounds like it leads to a deficit in the current account part of the BOPP.
That's often the result, yes. A current account deficit, meaning you're buying more from the world than you're selling.
And does inflation affect the currency demand side of this too?
It does, because you need to pay for all those extra imports, right? So the demand for foreign currency goes up.
Ah, which puts downward pressure on your own currency's exchange rate.
Exactly, causing it to depreciate further. And guess what? That depreciation can make the BOPP situation even worse because imports become even more expensive in domestic currency terms.
Another potential feedback loop.
It can be. And policymakers might react, maybe by hiking interest rates to attract foreign capital and support the currency.
But that has downsides too, right? Like slowing down the domestic economy.
Absolutely. Higher interest rates can dampen investment and consumption at home, potentially hurting growth and increasing unemployment. It's always a trade-off.
So maintaining price stability, keeping inflation low, isn't just about domestic comfort. It's fundamental for, well, for a healthy trade balance and external stability too.
It really is. Our sources really emphasize that connection. You can't really sustain external balance if your internal prices are out of control.
Okay, let's pivot now to economic growth. We hear GDP figures all the time. What's the basic definition and how does growth typically interact with inflation?
Economic growth is, at its core, just an increase in the production of goods and services in an economy over a period of time, usually measured by the change in gross domestic product, or GDP.
Right.
Now, the link with inflation. Well, if an economy is growing really fast, aggregate demand, the total demand for goods and services, might start to outrun aggregate supply, the economy's ability to produce.
Too much money chasing too few goods.
That's the classic demand pull inflation, yes. Very common during economic booms.
Is that the only way growth can cause inflation?
No, there's also cost push inflation. Growth can sometimes come with rising costs for businesses. Maybe wages go up as the labor market tightens, or raw material prices increase, or even that imported inflation we talked about earlier kicks in.
Okay.
Businesses then often pass these higher production costs onto consumers in the form of higher prices.
So growth seems like it often brings inflation along for the ride.
Mm.
But is that always true? Can you have growth without causing prices to shoot up?
That's a really important distinction the sources make. Not all growth is necessarily inflationary.
Also,
if the growth is driven by improvements on the supply side of the economy, think about things like technological breakthroughs, increases in worker productivity, more efficient use of resources.
Making more stuff more easily.
Exactly. If the economy's capacity to produce goods and services expands significantly, then you can have growth without necessarily triggering inflation. In fact, sometimes productivity gains can even put downward pressure on prices.
So the source of the growth matters a lot.
Critically, growth fueled purely by demand is more likely to be inflationary than growth fueled by supply side improvements.
Which brings us back to that balancing act for policymakers, doesn't it? Trying to encourage growth and jobs, but without letting the economy overheat and cause runaway inflation.
That's the perennial challenge. Finding that sweet spot, sustainable, non-inflationary growth. It's the holy grail of macroeconomics, really.
And does this growth challenge also spill over into the balance of payments we were just discussing? How does a growing economy affect its external accounts?
It certainly does. It's, again, nuanced. When an economy grows, people's incomes generally rise.
Right. More money in pockets.
And with more income, people tend to buy more stuff, including imported goods and services,
mm-hmm.
cars, electronics, holidays abroad, you name it.
So higher growth often means higher imports.
Often, yes. This increased demand for imports can lead to a widening of the current account deficit in the BOP because more money is flowing out to pay for those foreign goods.
But surely there are cases where growth actually helps the BOP, maybe through exports.
Oh, absolutely. Think about export-led growth. This is a strategy where a country's economic expansion is primarily driven by selling its goods and services to the rest of the world.
Like Germany or China, maybe?
Those are classic examples, yes. In that scenario, growth is associated with improving the balance of payments, specifically the current account, because the country is earning more foreign currency from its exports, potentially leading to trade surpluses.
So it depends on what is driving the growth.
Exactly. And there's another layer our sources add, how the growth is financed. If a country relies heavily on borrowing from abroad, or needs to import a lot of capital goods like machinery to fuel its growth,
yep.
that might put pressure on the capital account of the BOP, even if the current account looks okay initially. It's about the sustainability of how growth is funded.
Okay, so it's not just about if an economy grows, but how it grows and how that interacts with the rest of the world. Aligning growth with external strength seems key to avoiding problems down the line.
Precisely. Growth built on shaky external foundations, like persistent large deficits financed by volatile capital flows, isn't usually sustainable in the long run.
Right, it creates vulnerabilities.
Big time.
Okay, let's shift to perhaps the most famous relationship in macroeconomics.
Yeah.
The link between inflation and unemployment. The Phillips curve. Can you walk us through the original idea?
Sure. The traditional Phillips curve, based on observations by A.W. Phillips, showed this apparent inverse relationship.
Inverse meaning?
Meaning when unemployment was low, inflation tended to be high, and when unemployment was high, inflation tended to be low. It looked like a stable trade-off.
Why would that happen?
The thinking was low unemployment means a tight labor market. Employers have to compete for workers, pushing wages up. Higher wages mean higher costs for businesses, leading to cost-push inflation. Also, with more people working and earning, demand in the economy is strong, potentially causing demand pull inflation too.
And this suggested policymakers had a choice.
That was the initial implication, yeah. In the short run, it seemed they could choose a point on this curve, accept a bit more inflation to get unemployment down, or tolerate higher unemployment to keep inflation low.
But that view didn't last, did it? People like Milton Friedman and Edmund Phelps came along and complicated the picture.
They really did. They introduced a crucial element, expectations. Specifically, inflation expectations.
How did that change things?
Friedman and Phelps argued that any trade-off was only temporary. Sure, a government could use expansionary policies like cutting interest rates or increasing spending to push unemployment below its natural rate for a while.
The natural rate being?
Sort of the baseline level of unemployment that exists even when the economy is healthy due to frictions in the labor market, people changing jobs, etc. It's sometimes called NARU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
Okay, so you can push below it temporarily.
But Friedman and Phelps said, people aren't fools. They'll notice prices are rising faster. Workers will start demanding higher wages to keep up with inflation. Businesses will anticipate higher costs and raise their prices proactively.
Ah, so expectations adjust.
Exactly. And as inflation expectations rise, that original short-run Phillips curve actually shifts upwards.
Yay.
Meaning you end up back at the natural rate of unemployment, but now with a higher rate of inflation. Or worse, you could get stuck in stagflation, high inflation and high unemployment happening at the same time. Something the traditional curve couldn't explain, but which we saw in the 1970s.
So the introduction of expectations basically broke that simple trade-off idea, especially in the longer term.
That's the key takeaway. It led to the concept of the long-run Phillips curve.
And what does that look like?
It's generally depicted as a vertical line at the natural rate of unemployment, or NARU.
Vertical? Meaning?
Meaning, in the long run, there is no trade-off between inflation and unemployment. The economy will tend to operate at its natural rate of unemployment, regardless of the steady rate of inflation. Trying to use policy to keep unemployment consistently below that natural rate won't work. It will just lead to accelerating inflation, higher and higher price rises without any lasting benefit for employment.
Wow. So that initial simple relationship got much, much more complex once expectations entered the frame.
It fundamentally changed how economists and policymakers thought about managing inflation and unemployment.
Okay. What a tour. We've really gone through the internal plumbing of the economy, seeing how inflation, the BBOP, growth, unemployment, they're all tangled together. Pull one wire and others twitch.
Mm-hmm.
So wrapping this up, what's the big message for you listening right now when you see economic news flying around?
I think the main thing is to appreciate these interconnections. A policy aimed squarely at, say, boosting growth might unintentionally stir up inflation or worsen the trade deficit.
Right. It's rarely just one effect.
Exactly. Pushing down on one part of the system often makes another part bulge out, like you said earlier. It really underscores why policymakers need a balanced, coordinated strategy.
Not just fixing problems one by one in isolation.
Precisely. Managing inflation, unemployment, growth, and external stability, they all need to be considered together. Understanding these links, like we've tried to unpack today, is just vital for anyone trying to make sense of economic policy debates. It helps you see the whole chessboard.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. Next time you hear about a central bank changing interest rates or read about the latest trade figures, try to think beyond the headline. How might that decision ripple through the other parts of the economy we've talked about? Understanding these connections might just give you a much deeper, more insightful view of the economic story unfolding around us.
It really does change how you see things.
Thank you so much for joining us on this Deep Dives. We hope you found it useful, and we encourage you to keep exploring this fascinating, interconnected world of economics.